Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A new study out last week in the Annals of Internal Medicine says people who avoid carbohydrates like bread and pasta and eat more protein and fat, even saturated fat, lose more weight and have fewer heart risks than those who avoid fat. Diets from Atkins to South Beach to Paleo have made the claim for years, but it's still arresting and still controversial. This hour on Point, protein and fat versus carbs. Again, you can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do you handle the balance? How do you handle the headlines? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from New Orleans is Dr. Lydia Bazzano, internist and cardiovascular researcher and professor of epidemiology and medicine at Tulane's School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. And she's one of the authors of the new study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine that suggests cutting carbs, not fat, can lead to more weight loss, healthier heart life. Dr. Lydia Bazzano, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Can you describe your experiment for us, please?
Sure. Our study was very simple. We wanted to compare the effects of a low-fat diet with those of a diet low in digestible carbohydrates to see which was better for weight loss and cardiovascular health. So we followed 148 people over the course of a year. These participants were clinically obese, so their body mass index was over 30. This is how we're defining obese. And they were randomly assigned to either the low-carbohydrate diet, consuming less than 40 grams of digestible carbohydrates per day, or a low-fat diet consuming less than 30% of daily calories from fat and less than 7% of calories from saturated fat. And we gave both groups dietary advice. So we helped them create meal plans, we gave them sample recipes, and they got nutritional counseling at regular intervals. Now, neither group had a strict calorie or exercise goal in this study.
Okay, and when you say digestible carbohydrates, what distinction are you making there?
So digestible carbohydrates are different from indigestible carbohydrates or fiber. Dietary fiber is an indigestible carbohydrate. So an easy way to calculate digestible carbohydrates using nutrition information available on food labels is to subtract the grams of dietary fiber from the total carbohydrates in a serving of food.
Put it in terms of foods that people would know. What would be digestible, what not digestible? So lay that out for us.
Okay, so if you're looking at a serving of cereal and you look at the nutrition label, the majority of a serving of something, say cornflakes, is going to be digestible carbohydrates. And then on that nutrition label, you'll see a line that's called dietary fiber. So you take the line that says total carbohydrates on the nutrition label and subtract off the dietary fiber.
But I mean, almost all vegetables are carbohydrates, right? So are you saying that you are taking, vegetables and beans and lentils, nuts off the table here? Or how did that figure?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. So most vegetables actually have very little in the way of digestible carbohydrates and a lot of fiber. So when we're talking about beans and lentils, they have both soluble fiber and indigestible insoluble fiber that we call roughage. So vegetables, we recommended a long list of vegetables: artichokes, cauliflower, peppers, asparagus, celery, mm-hmm. salad greens, especially those leafy greens, have very little carbohydrates.
So when you were saying low carbohydrate, it's really kind of the bread, pasta family, that sort of thing that you're pushing people away from in that low-carb diet.
Exactly, exactly. We were getting people away from the white bread, white rice, white potatoes. Those were the things that were certainly not recommended.
And on the high protein, high fat side, what sort of foods were you steering people toward?
So we gave both of the groups the same education on what were recommended fats and what were not recommended fats. So we recommended monounsaturated fats, which were olive oil, olives, peanuts, peanut oil, avocados, canola oil, cashews. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we also recommended some polyunsaturated fats, and that includes the corn oil, sunflower oil, mm-hmm. walnuts, flax seeds. And we did not recommend that they consume the saturated fats. This was not an endorsement of saturated fats. So we said, stay away from the palm oil, the lard, the whole dairy with heavy whipping cream, butter, poultry with the skin on. We asked people to take the skin off of their chicken when they were cooking it.
But you didn't take ribeye steak off their menu. I mean, that was part of it. And people in your higher-fat diet consumed it, right, the saturated fat?
That, to some degree, they did consume some saturated fat. And we didn't take it off the menu. We made recommendations. This was a free-living behavioral study. Mm-hmm. We didn't give people the foods. With the exception of one supplement bar or shake that they could optionally pick up at the dietary counseling sessions, we did not give people foods.
So on the higher fat, higher protein side, was this wasn't like the Atkins diet, or how would it compare with an Atkins diet that had people gobbling down meat and you know, beef fat years ago?
This was not the Atkins diet. This had a carbohydrate restriction, but we educated our participants on what were good quality carbohydrates. Again, those vegetables, the beans, legumes, and what were good quality fats in order to select those over the bad quality ones.
All right, so we've got a general idea here. And in your findings, what were the weight consequences at the end of 1 year? What were the heart health consequences, Dr. Bozzano?
Okay, so after a year, both groups lost weight. But the low-carbohydrate group lost an average of 7.7 pounds more than the low-fat group. And we also found that the low-carbohydrate group had some surprising heart benefits. So the blood levels of certain fats that are predictors of heart disease improved more on the low-carbohydrate diet. The so-called bad cholesterol or low-density lipoprotein cholesterol was about the same for both groups. It went down about the same in both groups. But the low-carbohydrate group saw a spike in their good or HDL, high-density lipoprotein cholesterol. And they saw an improvement in the ratio of the total to the good cholesterol.
How would you explain those findings? How would you explain why they lost more weight? How would you explain why a diet higher in protein and fat would have created those heart health benefits, according to your study?
So our diet was higher in fat calories. That's absolutely true. So about 42% of calories were coming from fat, but the majority of that was the mono and polyunsaturated fats. And so that really plays into the good benefits that we found and the improvement in cardiovascular disease risk factors.
What about weight? Why would more fats mean less weight? To many minds, it's counterintuitive.
Well, there are a lot of different theories about the weight loss, and certainly the breakdown of fat in the body to ketones is one that plays into a lot of low-carbohydrate diets. So the body generally uses sugars as fuel, and when there are fewer sugars available, it breaks down fat into fuel bodies that are called ketones, and so the brain and the muscles can use these other sources of fuel. And so that's one possibility to explain the differences in weight loss that we saw. Now, this was not a very, very low carbohydrate diet. So this was not, again, I mentioned it's not equivalent to the Atkins. And in the Atkins diet, the carbohydrates are extremely low, and that's not really something that's sustainable over the long term, typically.
Dr. Bazzano, I've just got you for another minute. If I'm standing in the market, the farmer's market or the supermarket, and I'm thinking of your study, what am I going to be reaching for to get the benefits you found here? What am I going to be avoiding?
Okay, so if you're in the supermarket, you want to reach for those green leafy vegetables, get your salad greens, romaine, bib, endive, get your spinach, eggplant, broccoli. Definitely get your vegetables. Get your fruits that have a lower load of carbohydrate, like blueberries. 3/4 cup of blueberries have about 15 grams of carbohydrates. Get your Greek yogurt that has a high protein load, preferably the 0% fat Greek yogurt. Get your lean proteins like chicken and fish.
And avoiding?
Avoiding the white potatoes, white bread, white rice, butter. You don't want to load up on the butter. Don't load up on the burgers. Avoid your red meats, your fatty meats. If you're interested in soy products, get your soy milk instead of your skim milk. It has a little bit less in the way of carbohydrates.
And there is a formula in what has come to seem almost an age-old back and forth on the protein, fat versus carbohydrate front. Dr. Lydia Bazzano, one of the authors of the new study, results out in the Annals of Internal Medicine, joining us today from Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine in New Orleans. Dr. Bazzano, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks again for having me, Tom.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the old diet fight again, protein and fat versus carbs. A new study says protein and fat is the way to go, but you'd better know more than that, it turns out. I want to go first to Dr. Darius Mozafarian, Dean of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University, co-author of a March study in the Annals of Internal Medicine that called into question many concerns about saturated fats. He's a cardiologist. Dr. Mozafarian, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on the program, a favorite of my wife.
Wonderful. What did you think of this study? We just heard from Dr. Bazzano out of Tulane. What are you hearing in this? Are they seconding your greater ease with fats? And where should this be pushing our overall understanding of an optimal diet?
Well, I think what's really new here is that the participants were just told to change the composition of their diet and not to focus on cutting calories. There's been many trials looking at this question before that, in addition to changing what people were eating, gave a lot of guidance and a lot of focus to cutting portion sizes, cutting calories, and so forth. And why that's important is, on any kind of diet, anything you eat for 3 to 6 months, if you really focus and work really hard and get super motivated and cut your calories, you'll lose weight. And that's why all these fad diets, any book you could write with any kind of diet, the egg diet, the caramel diet, you can lose weight in 3 to 6 months, over 3 to 6 months. But long term, that doesn't stick. And so the really important question is, how does just changing your diet composition, what you eat, affect your weight gain, weight loss? And so I think this trial is the first and the largest to do that, to not do two things at once, both focus on calories and focus on what you eat, but just focus on what you eat. And what they found is, really just focusing on what you eat alone, that it's much more important to cut the carbs in the diet and to increase fats, healthy fats, and be more liberal about that. And I think that's a really important message and consistent with a wealth of evidence about the harms of processed carbohydrates, refined grains, and sugars.
We remember way back when fats got the big scare label around them. And I think a lot of people stampeded to carbs in those days because fats looked so scary for a while.
Well, I don't think there was ever really a stampede. I think that the low-fat message has kept in the consciousness, and it's so hard to shake. Even Dr. Bozzano, I heard in her comments, said lean meats. She suggested 0% yogurt. You know, she still sort of had trouble saying eat full-fat yogurt, which is probably as good, if not better, for you than low-fat yogurt. So I still think the low-fat message, even though there was a blip of trying to get away from carbs, it was really a blip. And that low-fat message has stuck. I mean, the U.S. Dietary Guidelines has moved away from it a little bit, you know, has gone from a 30% ceiling on fat to a 35% ceiling on fat. But I actually think there should be a floor. We should have a minimum level of fat in our diet as long as it's healthy. And there's the 35% is made up. The Bozzano study, many other studies, a recent trial in Spain showed that when you increase your fats, your healthy fats, above 40%, people do better. And so I think, you know, there's still a fat fear in this country that's really not based on strong science.
So in food on the shelves terms, what would you recommend then that people are reaching for more often and for less often?
Well, I think that's exactly the right question. You know, we in the end, people don't eat types of fats, they eat foods, and so we really should have food-based guidelines. And so I think, you know, our food-based guidelines should be to eat lots of minimally processed, healthful foods, which includes fruits, nuts, which are very rich in fats, vegetable oils, especially extra virgin olive oil, soybean oil are probably the two with the strongest evidence for health benefits. Dairy products, including a mix of milk, cheese, and yogurt. And as I said, I don't think there's strong evidence to support low or whole fat. You know, just eat what you like until the scientists figure it out. I suspect it doesn't make a big difference. You know, either is fine. There's good evidence, actually, if you eat low-fat dairy, you just eat more carb. You just replace those calories in your day with carb. So I think whole fat is fine. Fish, you know, it basically looks like the traditional kind of Mediterranean diet, whole grains. And then avoid sugar-sweetened beverages, potatoes, white bread, white rice, crackers, you know, highly refined breakfast cereals. You know, what's really 50% of the calories in our diet is all of these refined carbs. And it's not just sugars. That's the key message. It's also carbs. And so I've said this, you know, before, and people, you know, are surprised, and not all scientists agree, but I think the evidence is pretty clear that eating a bagel is just like eating a bowl of Skittles. You know, it's just within you know, seconds in your mouth, the long chains of glucose are digested, and within minutes in your stomach, you just have free glucose that's rapidly absorbed into your bloodstream. So, you know, avoid the carbs, avoid high sodium, you know, packaged foods, and really focus on minimally processed, healthful foods.
We're going to go to a big critic of this new study in just a moment here. A call or two first. Susan in Oxford, Michigan. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, my comment is that I have struggled with weight issues my whole life. I'm now at a healthy weight. I'm going to be 60 in December, so I've tried all these different diets. I found for myself it's very hard for me to overeat healthy protein, but if I start indulging in refined carbs, the white sugars, the white flours, there it does something to my particular chemical system in my brain where I want more and more and more, instead of my body giving me the signal I've had enough the way it does when I eat healthy protein. I want to ramp it up, just like an alcoholic. So I have what I call my alcohol foods that I avoid because I can't handle it.
Susan, I think I can relate to what you're saying there. Let me take it to Dr. Mozafari. And Doctor, what about it? Susan, looking at refined carbs as sort of the crack cocaine of the supermarket.
Well, you know, every individual person is different, so any one person could react differently. But I think that her experience is the more common experience. That's the average experience. And, you know, when you mentioned Atkins a couple times, Dr. Atkins' theory was you had to get carbs close to zero to activate ketogenesis, this process that he thought would burn fat. You know, he had the harms of the carb right, but the mechanism wasn't really the most important mechanism. Carbs, you know, refined carbs, rapidly digested carbs, whether it's starch or sugar, act through so many adverse pathways in the body. They activate brain reward and craving, just as this caller was describing. They activate fat synthesis in the liver. They increase glucose and insulin responses. They may even change our expenditure, how much energy you burn. There's so many adverse effects that, you know, cutting refined carbs is important. And so I think that experience is, you know, a common one.
Let me go to Dr. David Katz, if I may. Stand by, Dr. Mozafarian. David Katz is director of the Yale University Prevention Research Center. He joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. An internist, editor-in-chief of the Journal of Childhood Obesity. David Katz, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you, and hello to my friend Darius as well.
Dr. Katz, you have been blazingly critical of this new study in the Annals of Internal Medicine, saying go more heavily toward protein and fat, go low carb. What's the heart of your critique?
Well, it's really two things, Tom. First, if this had been a study of low fat versus low carb, I think it would have been extremely silly because those are really obsolete concepts. And I think everybody speaking on the program has said that. Lydia emphasized wholesome foods, and you asked her what diet she recommended in the low-carb group, and she started with vegetables and fruits, which are, you know, at the heart of a low-fat, healthy diet. And Dr. Mozafarian emphasized, as I do, that we really need to be focusing on eating wholesome foods, not jettisoning a class of macronutrient. And, you know, if we're honest about it, cutting fat wholesale means cutting nuts and seeds and avocado, and, you know, that was yesterday's news yesterday. And cutting carbs wholesale does mean cutting fruits and vegetables along with whole grains and maybe nuts and seeds and even beans and lentils. Just silly. So it would have been silly if the study had been about that, but it wasn't about that because, as Dr. Mozafarian mentioned, you know, basically the recommendation for the entire population has long been, you know, aim for a fat intake below 35% of calories. And at baseline in this study, all of the participants had a fat intake of about 35% of calories. What was the study goal for the low-fat group? 30% of calories. In other words, let's change almost nothing about their diet. In contrast, the low-carb group had a baseline intake of 240 grams of carbohydrate a day, and the goal was 40 grams of carbohydrate a day, a massive change in their diet. So in essence, when you get through all the smoke screens and the hyperbolic headlines, essentially I would sum up this study as a comparison of a lot of change from baseline diet to almost none. And then what happened?
Well, you mean dropping a lot or changing what? Not eating that much more fat, but eating a lot fewer carbs.
Well, again, you know, basically the low-fat assignment was change your fat intake a tiny bit and, you know, basically very, very modest, if any, meaningful change to the diet people came into the study with. Whereas the low-carb goal was a massive change in daily carbohydrate intake. So, you know, again, it was let's compare a big change to a small change. Well, guess what happened? The big change resulted in many fewer calories. You asked Lydia, you know, can she account for more weight loss on the low-carb diet? Yeah, I can. You just need to examine Table 2 in the paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which shows that the folks given the much more restrictive low-carb diet assignment were taking in about 200 calories fewer each day for the first several months of the study, and even all the way out at a year when everybody was busy falling off the wagon.
Is that because it's just harder to eat more calories when you're on a low-carb diet? You heard our caller from Michigan saying she touches the carbs and, boom, she wants to wolf them down. Maybe protein fat just doesn't elicit that.
You know, we could go that way, Tom. I don't think we need to because, again, beans and lentils are carbohydrate sources. They're extremely nutrient-rich. They're sources of protein as well. They're loaded with fiber. They're very satiating. Nuts and seeds have carbohydrate. They're very satiating. I think it's very well known that junky food is actually designed to maximize the number of calories it takes to feel full. So if we use carb to really mean, you know, white bread and added sugar, then yes, those are the addictive components of the diet, and those are the problem. But no, I would argue that the reason the people in the low-carb assignment, so-called low-carb assignment here, took in fewer calories is they were given instructions to change their baseline diet a lot. They had more rules. So they took in fewer calories, they lost more weight, and then are we surprised that they had more improvement in their cardiac risk measures? No, because they lost more weight, and the reason their cardiac risk measures were a mess in the first place was because of obesity. So again, you know, essentially we should see past all of the my diet can beat your diet nonsense. It's very interesting now that the first thing recommended by someone who's advocating for a low-carb diet is vegetables and fruits, which again are the beating heart of a healthy low-fat diet. The emphasis needs to be on wholesome foods and sensible combinations. This study did nothing to change that.
Questions for both of you. Sarah in Brookline, Massachusetts. Sarah, thanks. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So when I read the study, I thought this is totally validating for me because I'm the kind of person who's really has never really avoided fat, even when it was like banned and, you know, low fat diets were really popular.
Yeah.
And I've just sort of stayed, eating what I like to eat. And I found that when I eat something with more fat, it makes me feel fuller longer, which is sort of what I think this diet is finding. And
so your cupboards are not full of fat free foods.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I just thought this is ridiculous because when I looked at the labels, it seemed like they were just replacing fat with sugar. And, you know, sugar is really not what I want. I would rather have the fat than the sugar.
Okay. So what's your question, Sarah?
So my question is, when I go, you know, when I go to the store, there's like 10 different kinds of yogurts to buy, and there's 10 different amounts of fat in each one. There's the low fat, there's the non-fat, there's the full fat. And is there a difference between buying you know, like a regular, or in, even in terms of milk, like even in terms of buying like a 2% milk versus buying a whole milk, like what's the difference? Is it still better to buy a 2% because there's less fat and there's less, you know, like
we've got it. And I think anybody who stood in the supermarket has wondered the same thing. Let's take it to both of my guests, Dr. Mozafarian. I'll come first to you. Let's just use milk as a measure here. What do you recommend? Whole, 2%, 1%, fat-free?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, there is a strong focus on reducing fat in this country, to where if you look at the NIH guidelines or NHLBI guidelines for what families should be eating, they recommend that kids and families should be eating fat-free salad dressing. You know, what's fat-free salad dressing? It's starch, sugar, and salt. You know, that ginger snaps are sort of in the same category as vegetables with added fat, and that whole eggs should be avoided in the same category as soft drinks. So there's a fat fear that remains in this country, and the upper limit on fat that I mentioned is a symptom of that. So, you know, what's the actual evidence? For dairy, it's remarkable how little evidence there is that whole fat dairy is any worse than low-fat dairy. And in contrast, there's quite a bit of evidence that they're at worst the same. And so we looked at this among three large populations for long-term weight gain, over 100,000 men and women followed for more than 20 years, and we found that there was absolutely no difference between whole fat and low fat milk in terms of long term weight gain.
What about heart health?
And heart health also has been looked at, and milk is pretty neutral milk, cheese, and yogurt all are pretty neutral for heart health. For diabetes, interestingly, both yogurt and cheese have been linked to lower risk of diabetes, and cheese, of course, is mostly fat. We've looked at biomarkers of dairy fat intake in the blood and found that people who have higher levels of dairy fat intake based on blood biomarkers have lower risk of diabetes as well.
So I think Sarah is standing there in front of the milk case, and what is she reaching for in your ideal world? Whole, 2%, 1%, fat-free?
Well, so I would say the first thing is we don't have conclusive science to guide that decision, and so since we don't
thanks a lot, Doc.
Well, so since we don't have conclusive science, do whatever you'd like because we don't know. But I think that the evidence is pointing toward, you know, whole milk and probably more likely cheese and yogurt, maybe given other aspects of fermentation or other things, being good for you. And so I would suggest choosing whole.
Let me put the same question to Dr. Katz before the break coming up here. David Katz, what do you say to that question?
Yeah, Sarah, I think it's a good question, and I agree entirely with Darius that the evidence is unclear at this point. If you wanted a definitive statement, over time, does routine intake of whole-fat dairy versus non-fat dairy influence health, all other things being equal? You could imagine that would be a hard study to do. I'm intrigued by the science that's evolving, showing that whole-fat dairy in the context of a healthy diet is not harmful. I would also note that the blue zones, those populations around the world where people live the longest and are the healthiest, like, for example, Greece, routinely include dairy. But what they don't do is add sugar or high fructose corn syrup or aspartame, and we do. So the big problem with the fat-free dairy isn't that they've taken out the saturated fat, because personally in my diet, I don't restrict fat, but I want most of my fat to be the best of, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated, omega-3, so I don't go out of my way to add saturated fat. But very often, the fat-free yogurt is a concentrated source of added sugar or artificial sweeteners or other things. So here's my recommendation. What I eat is fat-free organic dairy, but with no added sugar. So part of my daily diet, for example, fat-free organic plain Greek yogurt, and I add the fruit.
Music. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a new study that's come out saying high protein, high fat diet better than high carb diet. Go high on the fat and protein, low on the carbs, and you'll be better off in weight. You'll be better off in heart health. There is a lot of nuance around that, and it's important to hear it. This conversation has been going on for a long time now. We're still looking at where to set the needle. Dr. David Katz is with us, but maybe we're getting a much better idea. David Katz from the Yale University Prevention Research Center is with us. Editor-in-chief of the journal Childhood Obesity joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. From Boston, Dr. Darius Mozafarian is with us, dean of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. How long has this been around? Here's a little bit from Woody Allen's 1973 movie. That is now a long time ago. Sleeper. Here's a little passage where a health food store owner, Miles Monroe, is frozen and thawed out 200 years in the future when fat is apparently back big time. Here are two doctors in the movie talk about what Allen's character from the 20th century had requested for breakfast.
This morning for breakfast, he requested something called wheat germ, organic honey, and tiger's milk.
Oh, yes, those are the charmed substances that some years ago were felt to contain life-preserving properties.
You mean there was no deep fat? No steak or cream pies or hot fudge?
Those were thought to be unhealthy. Precisely the opposite of what we now know to be true.
Incredible.
Incredible from Woody Allen's Sleeper. Dr. Mozafarian, are you worried that headlines like we saw out of the study last week are going to bring back a deep fat, steak, cream pies, hot fudge?
Well, so I do worry about the public's misperception of nutrition science as sort of changing randomly. I think that, you know, all science advances and has advanced, and with those advances you get conclusions that were diametrically opposed to the previous ones, but that doesn't mean that the current science is also going to be completely wrong, you know, when it's supported by evidence. This is just the advance of science. This happens in physics and chemistry and medicine. You know, nobody goes to their doctor and says, you know, please treat me with the best treatment you had for my condition 20 years ago. They want the new science. And so somehow in other fields, you know, physics, genetics, and so forth, when science advances, people are comforted. But in nutrition, people get upset. And I think it's because, you know, nutrition is so personal, people want to eat what they want to eat. And so, you know, they don't like it when the science that they liked changes to some other message. But the science has changed. And so I think that there really has been a change in our science from a focus on low-fat diets to understanding that not just sugars, you know, now people are getting it about sugars, but not just sugars, but refined carbs. And I agree with David. It's not all carbs. It's refined carbs, you know, white bread, white rice, rapidly digestible carbohydrates, potatoes, are harmful. And so I think with that advance, and then fats, especially healthy fats, are actually very good for us. And we should be not only eating them just in case we need a little bit of fat, but we should actually be richly eating them and increasing their intake in our diet above our current levels. Healthy fats like nuts and fish and healthy vegetable oils. So I think that the science has advanced. But the science does not say that processed meats or meats are good for us. Red meats are probably kind of neutral on average. But, you know, what's interesting is this low-fat focus has taken us away from sort of freshly prepared steak to low-fat deli meats, which are, you know, loaded with sodium. And so now we're choosing, you know, low-fat, fat-free turkey and low-fat, fat-free chicken and putting it on sandwiches. And that's actually, that intake has gone up in this country considerably. And that's associated with much higher risk of diabetes and heart disease than intake of unprocessed red meat. So it shows that, you know, this study and the evidence does not say to eat meat, but it does say that if you're going to eat meat, at least eat a fresh, you know, meat that's freshly prepared rather than focusing on low fat.
Dr. Mozafarian, Dr. Katz, stand by. Michael Moss joins us right now from New York, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times and author of the big book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael Moss, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, Tom. Good to see you.
What's your sense of the public realm of perception that studies like this drop into? What's your sense of how close the widely understood sense of what we ought to be eating is now to what science is suggesting? Are they aligning or are they really askew?
You know, I loved your intro, Tom, when you said, you know, in part sort of how to handle the headlines and being a member of the media, I have to take some responsibility for media interpretation of very subtle, complicated studies that tend to create headlines like sugar is bad, fat is bad, salt is bad. Because every nutritionist I talk to who I trust, you know, they have been saying consistently, if you want to lose weight, eat less. If you want to eat healthier, eat lots more vegetables. And they also sort of point out that, look, all diets work until they don't. And that, you know, meaning that it's easy to lose weight, but really hard to sustain that and keep those pounds off. And as per your first caller and sort of the focus of my reporting was what destroys many of these diets so often is that extraordinary science that goes into making junk food addictive, kind of both in their formulas and the marketing strategies. And I, in this case, would love to know more about what exactly the participants in this study were eating and how they dealt with that deluge of junk food, hyper-processed, both the stuff in the store and the marketing and the advertising.
But you know, there was a time, I mean, it's years ago now, that many people retreated to, let's say, pasta because it seemed like the safe island when fat was the boogeyman, right? And now you're saying no junk food, but in the description I'm hearing today, white bread and pasta almost start sounding like junk food because those are refined carbohydrates.
They are, and probably, you know, hyper-processed is probably a better term to be using in that sense. But again, I mean, when you listen closely to nutrition experts, including those you have today, who are just fantastic, you do consistently sort of have been hearing this message for years and years. And so somehow that's getting lost in the translation of either the news reports about the studies and the research and or people's desire for a silver bullet. Look, I mean, this is really hard stuff. If you are overweight and trying to lose that weight and keep it off, it's really, really difficult for a lot of people. And the temptation there is to look for one silver bullet, and it just doesn't exist.
Dr. Katz, you were really fired up about this study, and not in a good way. You called it propaganda. You called it prehistoric. And it's public perception, I think, that you were worried about. What's your concern?
Yeah, I should tell you what I really think.
Yeah, right.
Well, listen, delighted to be on with Darius and with Michael. Great guest, great show, great discussion. At first, Sleeper was a hilarious movie,
yes.
But this is not hilarious in public health because real people are paying for this. This back and forth, my diet can beat your diet, the distortions of what the science is telling us, the failure to understand that this is incremental, and the failure to recognize just what's been going on this program. You get together genuine experts in nutrition, and frankly, we're all saying vegetables, fruits, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, whole grain. We're not saying I eat low carb, I eat low fat. That's prehistoric. It's antiquated nonsense. Cutting fat could be a good thing if you're eating lots of fatty meats and fries and butter, and you switch to lots of vegetables, lots of fruits, lots of beans, lots of lentils. But cutting fat is a byproduct of eating fewer junky foods and more good foods. Similarly, if you're eating lots of starch and added sugar, cutting carbs could be a good thing. If I leave behind only one message, Tom,
mm-hmm.
It's that talking about jettisoning a macronutrient class is unhelpful. It's prehistoric thinking. What we should focus on is wholesome foods and sensible combinations. Then we've got common ground. And by the way, that's also how we defend against what Michael Moss writes about, the science of addictive junk food. If you eat minimally processed foods, you don't play into the hands of big food, which pays teams of PhDs to design foods that are all but addictive and that we can't stop eating.
But Dr. Mozafarian is trying to coax, as I hear him, more fats back into our diet. How do you do that in the public communications game?
Well, if I may, Tom, I don't think it really matters because, frankly, you know, the Okinawans are a blue zone with a low-fat, plant-based Asian-style diet.
Yeah.
And the Cretans are also a blue zone with a much higher-fat Mediterranean-style diet. Frankly, I don't think we have to be dogmatic about a particular intake of fat. I think we can be fairly dogmatic that the typical American diet is junk. And, you know, again, Sleeper was funny, but modern public health isn't with epidemics of obesity and diabetes. It really is a serious problem. We should approach it more seriously.
Erica in Warren, Ohio. Thank you for calling, Erica. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yes.
This is a fantastic program, and I'm so excited to hear experts talking about the science behind so much of this diet rhetoric that we hear.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is specifically targeted to sugar and high fructose corn syrup and how that is now disguised and hidden in the majority of products that we see in modern grocery stores. And I wanted to know how, I read a little bit of the science about how high fructose corn syrup specifically can raise the your inflammation in your body, and then that can lead to disease processes such as diabetes and the cardiovascular disease. And I wanted to know if your panelists have any new information about how sugar and high fructose corn syrup can lead to those diseases.
Erica, through the wizardry of radio, I see a note here that says you're a family physician. Let me just ask you, I'll put it to them, but do you see what you perceive as problems showing up in your exam rooms when kids and families come in on this front?
Absolutely. There is a very big problem with obesity. And, you know, when I'm in the grocery store, I see people with their, you know, baskets full of processed food. And it's just really hard to get this message through in a non-threatening way. And it seems to me it could be an easy solution, but people don't seem eager to follow that advice of eating a healthy diet and not eating the processed foods.
Michael Moss, this is in your wheelhouse, the latest on high fructose corn syrup and sugars generally.
I haven't seen anything yet or heard anybody convincingly argue that sugar is anything, but sugar is sugar is sugar, and that high fructose corn syrup is any worse for you or better for you than table sugar. You know, maybe some argument for honey, for example, but I think it's still a wash.
Dr. Mozafarian?
So I think that I agree with Michael. There's really no strong, high fructose corn syrup is 50% fructose roughly and 50% glucose. That's what beet sugar is. That's what cane sugar is. So there's really not much difference. A separate question, an interesting question, is whether fructose, which is in all sugars, including high fructose corn syrup, is different than glucose. And I think, the evidence suggests that they act and are both harmful via different pathways when consumed at high doses that are rapidly digested. So if you have fructose in fruit, or if you have glucose, in a slowly digested whole grain, then they're probably neither are harmful. And if you have both in rapidly digested form in sugars and grains and refined starches, then they're both harmful through different pathways. But this idea of fructose being harmful, which is probably mostly what you've heard, has been transformed into high fructose corn syrup being uniquely harmful, which is there's no scientific evidence for, because it's just like beet sugar or table sugar.
Dr. Katz, Dr. Erica in Warren, Ohio is worried about it, and the whole sugar problem more generally that she sees driving obesity. We all see it.
Yeah. So Tom, I think a good question. I actually have the third edition of my nutrition textbook due out next week, so I've been obligated to review this literature pretty thoroughly. There is a biochemical and structural and even a metabolic difference between high fructose corn syrup and table sugar or sucrose. But we really don't have evidence that that matters much in terms of the public health, where our problem is we eat way too much added sugar, whatever it's called. And I think a reason to particularly indict high fructose corn syrup is it comes from inexpensive subsidized corn. And so over recent decades, total daily sugar intake in the U.S. has gone up massively, and all of that increase has been high fructose corn syrup. So our problem really is dose. As Paracelsus says, the dose makes the poison.
Yep.
And most of the dose is high fructose corn syrup. So therefore, it's largely responsible for the problem. It is, again, biochemically distinct from sucrose, but I think what we really ought to focus on is reducing our total intake of sugar under all of its aliases.
Cliff in Detroit, Michigan. Cliff, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Absolutely. Thanks, John.
Yes.
For taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Hey, my question is this. A lot of my neighbors around me have to shop. You guys are talking about a grocery store. They have to shop at a gas station or a liquor store. How would you, I'm asking your panelists, how would they suggest that they modify their diet to buy in healthy foods out of those types of places because they don't have anywhere else to go.
You're talking inner city, sort of a vegetable deserts, the problem we hear about where there just aren't good food sources available, Cliff.
Absolutely.
I appreciate your call. I'm not sure who's got this one. Michael Moss, if you're in that zone, and Cliff sounds like he knows it well and his neighbors, and you don't see abundant vegetable displays at the convenience store, what do you do?
That's a huge problem, access to the foods that we know we should be eating more of. In that case, you know, you've got to get in your car or take a taxi and go as far as you have to go to find a real grocery store with real food in it. There's just
Sounds expensive to add taxi fare to the grocery bill.
Not only that, but when you walk in the grocery store, Tom, it's going to be more expensive to buy those better for you vegetables than the, as your first caller said, the alcohol foods.
I don't know. What's the answer?
Go ahead, Darius. I'm sorry.
Sorry about that. So, you know, we're studying sort of policy approaches in our research groups here, and it's clear that diet is not an individual choice. There's so many external influences, and most of the U.S. dietary policies pretend that diet is an individual choice. So we'll just put a food label and let people make their own decisions. We'll just put out dietary guidelines.
But if Frito-Lay is the big provider in your shopping, store.
So we just put out a commentary in the Journal of the American Medical Association. I think it came out yesterday. Myself, David Ludwig, and Kenneth Rogoff, an economist, proposing that we change the food system. You know, we completely transform the food system by pretty much taxing all packaged foods and most chain restaurant foods and using those dollars to subsidize minimally processed foods. This would transform the food supply, making minimally processed foods remarkably cheap and inexpensive, and changing the demand for those foods, you know, changing the economic incentives for carrying those foods and dramatically increasing their consumption, and a modest tax, 10%, 15% tax on packaged foods and processed foods would easily pay for that and transform the food supply. Whether that is used or another policy is used, we need more than just education and leaving it to the individual. We need strong a policy at the city, state, and federal level.
Boy, if we really cared about our population in public policy terms, that sounds like a great idea. Plenty of energy has gone the other way to push those foods out. Maybe we could reel some of them in. What a great conversation, and I'm so grateful to all three of you for being with us to help us have it. Dr. Darius Mozafarian at Tufts University, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, and hi to Michael and David.
Dr. David Katz at the Yale University Prevention Research Center, thank you, Dr. Katz, for being here.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat. Thank you, Michael. Great to have you with us today.
Likewise, Tom.
Listeners, eat wisely, eat well. As well as you can. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.